This program is brought to you by PrideNZ.com.
Kia ora koutou, ngā mihi mahana kia koutou katoa, ko tau mai nei ki te tautoko tēnei kaupapa. Thank you all for coming. I'm really excited because for Queer History Month, Te Whana Whana has arranged a series of events. The first was with Wellington Pride to do the movie night, Poi'e, and the dance with dance. We had the dance upstairs on Saturday. And then the opening to our exhibition here was on Monday. So, I know I'm always, yep, we're going to dance, we're going to party, we're going to do art, and we're going to have fun, and then we're going to do some work. So, this is the work bit. So, thank you for coming for this. So, our format for tonight, quick fire. I know people have got great things going on their lives, even if that includes being on their couch watching TV. So I appreciate you've taken time out of your evening to be here. So we got two segments to tonight. The first, we're going to hear from some speakers, people who work and who do things in our community and do different ways of collecting information and how do we keep our stories alive with some examples of that. And then we're just going to spend the second hour doing some quick workshopping things, get out of the chair, do some moving around, and it's not interpretive dance or anything. It's not that kind of, out of your chairs thing. But yes, and so I would like to introduce our first speaker, and we're going to, each of the speakers will introduce actually themselves, and we're going to get the ball rolling, and you know the order, speaker, so we'll just roll. I'll remind you after each. So we're going to start. Thank you so much. I'm going to invite you to come on up and have a cordial.
Kia ora. I'm Gareth Watkins, and I founded Pride NZ in 2009, so I'm going to talk a wee bit about my background and also Pride NZ. But firstly, thank you, Elizabeth and Te Whana Whana, for and Leggins for offering this opportunity. It's really fantastic to be able to come and speak and share. To give you a bit of background about me, Mum came from Yorkshire in England, and Dad came from Tredegar in Wales, and they came out to New Zealand in 1960-something, in the 60s, and I was born in Wellington in the 70s. My connections with the United Kingdom have really kind of been disconnected, so I've kind of lost really connections with Tredegar, which was a small Welsh mining village in Yorkshire, and it just, I think, points to the those connections can easily be lost within a generation. And I kind of feel that a wee bit about the rainbow communities as well. It's very easy to forget, you know, what's been before us. And so I think that's one of the drivers for me for Pride NZ, is to make sure we try not to forget. I've been working in radio since 1990, mainly in public radio, but I've also done commercial radio and Wellington Access Community Radio. Two stories from Radio New Zealand, which I thought were quite interesting. In the mid-90s, I wanted to make rainbow-related documentaries, and so I went to a senior manager there, and they turned around and said, you can't have gay voices on the radio, because if one minority group are on air, then others will want to be. And I was thinking, well, what's the problem? but there was a problem. And so a lot of the documentaries I was making in the 90s actually were broadcast overseas, but they were never broadcast in New Zealand. So there's about six documentaries that haven't been broadcast in New Zealand, which is kind of interesting. The thing that pushed me out of Radio New Zealand in 2006 was a small thing, but it was a huge thing as well, was that we had done a program on disability, and there was an advert for that played on air, and a senior manager said, we must take this off air because this person sounds retarded, in quotation marks. And I just could not believe the fact that the managers at the time couldn't allow other voices to be on radio. So I did a quick exit of Radio New Zealand and went to Access Radio in Wellington. And Access Radio is a community station that has had a long association with a whole variety of groups and individuals that allows anyone to broadcast, and has had a long association with rainbow communities. So right back from the early broadcast in 1981, I think on the first broadcast there was a lesbian feminist program. And then there was the lesbian community program right from which Linda was helped set up, one of the founders, and Gay BC, which was around kind of homosexual.
My life saver.
Yeah. It's an amazing community platform to allow people to put across their views. In 2008, I undertook a Winston Churchill Memorial Fellowship when I was at Access Radio to look at community media in California in the US, and to look at sustainability. How do we keep things going? Because Access is always on a knife edge between whether it broadcasts or whether it doesn't. Got really inspired, came back to New Zealand thinking that, oh, there's all these wonderful people with so much passion. So I put a proposal into New Zealand On Air to get funding for a nationwide radio rainbow program that would have regional reporters, and they would come together and would do a weekly program. That was rejected. New Zealand On Air said that it needed to have a commercial backing, in terms of like it had to go to like a ZM or some commercial station, and there was no way that a commercial station was going to run half an hour of, you know, queer content in that kind of form. And so I've applied to NZ On Air about four times with various themes around that kind of Pride NZ type thing of having long form rainbow related material, and four times they've said no. But being turned down financially was actually really good, because actually it prompts you, it says, oh, well, you know, do it yourself, use the resources that you've got, don't wait for government funding, even if it's small, start small and just keep doing it. And Pride NZ's been going for 7 years now. This actually is the 700th recording that we're doing tonight, which is really cool. And to me, it's just amazing that it has kept going. And I think the reason it's kept going is because we just do it as we can, when we can. We don't try and be this huge, big organisation. It is, you know, if we've got the resource at the time, we do it. Otherwise, we just say, well, that would be nice to do. Let's work towards it. So we're not really setting ourselves up to kind of be huge and possibly fail. So basically I'm the executive editor, and then I coordinate recording projects, bringing people in to do projects like Jack did a wonderful project around the Butch on Butch series, also the homosexual law reform interviews, and Tabby's done and Connor's done some really amazing youth interviews. So it's kind of bringing people in and getting them kind of involved. And I love that idea of peer-to-peer interviewing, so it's youth interviewing youth, or elders interviewing elders, just because you have different access and those different groups ask different questions, so it's not always coming from the same point of view, which I really love. So some of the recordings we do are one-on-one interviews, so reflective, say looking back at somebody's life, looking back at a career, or current interviews, so it's what is happening to somebody in the moment. There's nothing like that kind of energy of we don't quite know what's going to happen. You know, there's a real energy to it that you don't get necessarily if you're reflecting back on something. We do one-off recordings, so like the Orlando Shooting Memorial, which was done by Inside Out, which organised that, which was an amazing event. Conferences like the Proud Conference. And even 30 years since homosexual law reform, we're still having firsts. Like last year we had the first, was it the Queer Writers Festival in Auckland? The first time in 30 years that had happened. So we were able to record that. So for me, it's not about one project standing out. It's about just the fact that Pride NZ exists after 7 years and that each recording builds this and contributes to this body of knowledge that we can share and kind of maintain. For me, yeah, it's all about the voices that kind of challenge what I think and challenge what other people think, but also affirm community as well. So I get a lot of kind of comfort from hearing kind of rainbow voices. In terms of gaps or concerns, stories that aren't being told, there are thousands of stories and voices that aren't being heard, but I don't think it's one organisation that will collect those stories. And sometimes stories aren't meant to be kept. You know, sometimes they just go. They are and they go. But so for Pride NZ, it's doing what we can, but also trying to help enable other groups to do their thing. So offering training for other groups to do podcasts and to get on radio, to kind of be an enabler. Sorry. Through training and support. My biggest concern, really, and I think Ellen will echo this, is the vulnerability of digital files. So we've got 700 recordings on Pride NZ. They're on two hard drives that have to migrate every 4 years. If they don't get migrated, the hard drive might fail. What happens if both hard drives fail? You know, we're stuffed. So the fragility of digital files is huge. So I think we'd love to work with, LAGANS in terms of developing a way of making sure that we can keep those digital files, because it's not like a bit of paper or a photograph which may survive 100 years. In 4 years' time, those files might not. So it's kind of scary thinking in those terms. But, thank you so much for inviting me, and I hope that was interesting.
I realise now I need to take notes.
Kia ora. Kevin Honer is my name, and my background is Māori. Effectively, both my parents are Māori, come from different parts of the country, and of course I inherited their histories of where they came from in terms of the people that went before them and the histories that were going on at the time for them. So I was brought up in the Bay of Plenty, born in Rotorua. Spent my early life in places like Te Whaiti and Murupara, which are really, really tiny places, where forestry was the main income for the small town of Murupara, and Te Whaiti, native forestry, was probably the income. But my parents were teachers, so they were... They came through the Ardmore Teachers College system, which meant, I think these days, that they were prepared to be teachers in a certain way, as Māori teachers. They had to serve a little bit of time at native Māori schools before they then went to primary schools. And I guess the reason why I'm telling you a little bit about my whakapapa in that sense and those histories is because I'm here to talk really about waiata as the, or songs as the means by which legacies, the means by which politics, the means by which emotions and all those sorts of things are conveyed. And so part of the history that comes from my father's side comes down through Te Kōti, who was a... well, actually, where I come from and the stories that the people told me, they use the words porohianga, which means a mischief. So, and I think that was somebody that challenges conventions, maybe, or the way that, that things are done. And so waiata was a particular form of protest that Te Kōti used to use. Change the words, reframe a waiata, and actually play it back or sing it back to his detractors. And so there's a famous oriori, I think it is. An oriori is like a chant called Pina Pina Te Kura, which is sung along the East Coast, and he reframed that particular waiata to talk about all the things that were going on at the time, land wars or land sales and so forth. So I talk about that because I've done a little composing, and the compositions that I write about come from the perspective of being gay or takatāpui in today's society. And so the song, for me, was a way of using the tools that I was most comfortable with, particularly with songs, but using those tools to reframe the voices which I wasn't hearing when I was growing up in terms of being takatāpui. There were no stories, there were no novels, really. There was no history, there was no scholarly base around takatāpui. And so I'd always grown up as a youngster knowing very well that I was same-sex attracted, or sexually attracted, probably sexually attracted to men. Well, became men. At that time, I was sexually attracted to anything. That was not anything, but sexually attracted. That's what I'll say. But the... and now I've gone across my phone call. But basically, the song was written to at a time when the Civil Union Bill was being debated, and the very public face of Māoridom during that time was the Destiny Church marches, because they were predominantly Māori and the church is all in black. It was also around the similar time that even the church and the Māori church, in terms of Bishop Virko, were saying, oh, you know, blah, 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 those sort of things. So this particular song was written in response to what I was seeing. And actually, I was in Sydney at the time that those marches were happening, and I saw it on TV, which actually gave it an even greater sense of importance to me, because here I was sitting overseas watching this going on and thinking that this is what people are seeing over in Sydney, and this is what they're thinking that Māori are all about. And I thought, no, that's not the case. So it is about creating... It is about creating a legacy, but in the first instance, it was actually a political response. And the legacy actually came after that, because the legacy is that people wanted to sing it, people wanted to create actions to go with the song. It took about 5 years or 6 years before the actions actually came to the song. The And when I talk about the song, I know we're talking about words, but there's actually a whole lot more to it as well. The whole storyline of the journey within the song, the different layers within the song, so that one of the layers is actually follows a welcoming process of with a wedo and right through to when you've finished your speeches and sung your song and you're coming together and so forth. The other aspects of it was to use the language of our forefathers as well. So it actually uses a lot of language that wasn't developed by me, but phrases that are well known within Māoridom to reflect the thoughts that I wanted within that song. So I think to myself, what can we learn from Waiata? Well, absolutely heaps. But as I say, it was also using the tools that I thought was most effective for my primary audience, which was Māori, and Waiata an essential part of that audience. Koina, I think? Kia ora tātou.
And just a quick note to add to that, because the humility that is given, is that we make sure as a group, as Te Whanawhana, we give life to that waiata by always singing it. It's our signature waiata, and when we teach it, we always teach the words, what it means in English, the history of it, and that's say that in that moment when Kevin was reacting to what was happening here, and he wrote these amazing, beautiful words, but still, it's 12 years later, we're still singing it. We sung it on Monday night. And so that's the way. A lot of it's one of the comments that was made at about Matatini. Te Matatini is all these new waiata written every 2 years for these big, massive performances and never sung again. Because they're responding to issues of the day, but then there's no groups writing the next ones and performing the next ones. And that's a real... Thomas, I just wanted to add that.
So that's a gap. If there's any gap, that's a gap, just to encourage that.
Yeah. Got it. You're
right. Kia ora. My name's Linda Evans, and I'm here partly as one of the curators of the Lesbian and Gay Archives, Te Puranga Takatāpui. My personal background is a kind of a hybrid. My biological family is in Irish and English, and came to this country sort of from in the second half of the 19th century right through to the 30s, various waves, and the Irish were Irish Catholics, so that was a particular perspective on history. But then for me also a big part of my background is being part of women's liberation and lesbian feminism, and that's my family as much as anything. And also for many years now I've lived in Paikakariki. So that's kind of become my place, even though it's not where I was born. And the Lesbian and Gay Archives is an organisation that has been around since 1977 in a slightly different form. And it's a little bit like Kevin was saying, you know, it came from activism, and I really like that. It was the archive, it was called the Lesbian and Gay Rights Resource Centre, and it was housed in a building in Balcott Street, which has since been demolished. And it was the archives of the National Gay Rights Coalition and Pink Triangle newspaper. And in fact, one of the, Roger Swanson, who's the other curator of the archive, one of our colleagues at work was one of the people who started organising those papers on a PEP job in the very beginning. So that was quite a neat kind of beginning. But then it became like a resource centre that was consciously developed by a couple of guys who were librarians, and the last one was Phil Parkinson, who worked really hard for many, many years, did a huge amount of work on the archive and building it up and making sure it was well documented. And also it was used as in an activist way. It was really important for law reform. It sort of produced background material and information for MPs and really became a specialist archive on HIV/AIDS as well. So it's kind of, you know, got a real activist background. In 1986, there was a fire, an arson attack on the archive. And so at that time, everyone regrouped and thought, "What? How can we make it more secure? It's very vulnerable being in a building that has other, you know, political groups, community groups, people living, you know, so you can't, it's not a secure building and you didn't want it to be one." But so with the cooperation of Phil Parkinson's colleagues from the Turnbull, most of the collection was salvaged and an arrangement evolved with the Turnbull Library so that the archive could be kept safe and secure there, which has got its pluses and minuses. It's certainly safe, and the Turnbull houses it and helps us provide access to the collection. The Trust still owns the collection. But, of course, it's not a place people can just walk into and browse. So we have to work out other ways to make things more accessible. And I think that's a kind of a big thing for me, of working out other ways to make things available, while still encouraging everyone to come in as well, because there'll be things that we're not going to be putting on the internet or making easily available outside, because, you know, people's names are there, people's personal details are there. The Lagans collects manuscripts, like the papers of groups, the papers of individuals, so which is, you know, a really important aspect of any archive. Our group's papers don't always survive. People move on, people move house. You know, sometimes the record keeping's not great because of the activist nature of many of the groups. And we have posters, other kinds of things that are produced in the course of creating our cultures, creating our political groups, and our events and our political actions. So posters, flyers, ephemera, buttons, you know, all of that kind of material. But also we're interested in personal accounts of what people's experiences are and their observations and their thoughts about things. And I guess that's where the oral history came in, which I see that Elizabeth has kind of put me down for as well, because it's my day job as curator of the Oral History Centre, as was, now the Oral History and Sound Collection at the Alexander Turnbull Library. And that's a job which at the moment focuses on the collection of recordings of interviews and events, but also can be involved with training and research and other aspects as well. And I think oral history is really valuable as a way of eliciting material, making sure people's voices are included, especially if they may not have large numbers of papers or a whole lot of other photographs or whatever to show for their lives and their activities. But I think oral history is valuable whether you're well known or not, because it can cover those mundane aspects of life. It can cover people's personal reflections. And I think one of the things where it differs a little bit from what Gareth is doing, which is so valuable, having all the material that's readily available, is if people wanted to speak frankly, they can retain some control over access to the material for some time if they want to. So that we can say, you know, we'd like to gather sensitive material on quite a sensitive topic and people to be free to talk openly about it, and then it can be restricted for a certain time, or there can be a permission procedure. So it's just got that extra layer possible. And then, you know, maybe in way into the future it will be available more widely, but for now it can be mediated, the access to it. So I think one of the... if you talk about a project that was that I was and we, I think we all have been happy with, that's been used and used and used, is the work we've done over the years around homosexual law reform. And Gareth did some really valuable digitisation work for us when we got a small grant, and we were able to digitise recordings relevant to law reform, some of those on Pride NZ, and David Hindley's wonderful photographs that have been, the images you often see of, especially of the Wellington aspect of the law reform campaign. But we'd like to, you know, make more material available now and work on some other topics, because what anything that's readily available is what gets used. And I think we would have noticed that during the celebrations, the anniversaries and stuff, everyone reaches for that material that's readily available, and those are the images that get reproduced, and those are the sound bites that get reproduced. And so it was great that we had them there, now we want to do more. In terms of the gaps, well, there's lots of gaps. I mean, we try to be comprehensive about all of our related communities in Aotearoa. We do have some overseas material because it's no doubt been really influential in what's happened here. And people have travelled to and fro. People have read stuff from overseas and been inspired by it. The fact that we don't have the ability yet to do preservation of digital material, we can collect it, but we don't have that access to preservation yet. That's one of our most urgent and pressing needs. And I think the other gap for us is, as people will know who volunteered to do volunteer work at the archive, we're kind of only on the threshold of organising ourselves to move forward with that, being able to draw on community resources. And we always would like more, and personal stories, personal photographs, so on. So if you've got anything that you think would be a good contribution to the archive, please talk to me or to Roger, and we'd be really happy to talk with you about it. And if anyone's got any questions later, happy to answer them.
Kilda. Going to try put Shuns on. Okay, and pressing
play. Ngā koutou katoa, ko Shan Torrington aho. Kia ora ti whanawhana, kia ora taktapui whanau. I'm Shan Torrington, and I've just finished a project called We Don't Have to Be the Building, which is currently on Courtney Place in the light boxes, and I'm here via video to talk about some of the processes around recording our stories through creative means through that project. So it was for me, it was about whakapapa, looking for my queer ancestors through activism and art making, starting with homosexual law reform 30 years ago. So that was a real catalyst for me this year. It really kicked me into action and sort of gave me permission to look for some of our stories as well. I used a consent-based model for this project, so I felt like it was okay for me to ask for people to be involved and talk to me and sit for me to be drawn, as long as it was always okay for people to say no at any point through the process. Someone asked me recently what the methodology was, and I said curiosity, creativity, care, layering, acceptance, stuff like that. So for me it was quite a human sort of project. It wasn't academic, but it was a research project through various media. So I started in Leghams in the Lesbian and Gay Archives, and they showed me a lot of stuff about the history that I didn't know, and particularly around solidarity, politics, conflict and divisions within our community, divisions that were then there 30 years ago and that are still there now. They showed me things I didn't expect. The project was focused on the queer female support of homosexual law reform, and from there an expanded look at what prevents us from freely accessing and exploring our own bodies, genders and sexualities. One of the things I found in the archives in Leghams was about the exclusion of bisexual women at that time in the 80s and 90s from feminist, from lesbian spaces, from women's spaces. I didn't know about that. It was really painful to learn about that and read about that in the archives. And as a researcher and as an artist, I had to address that in my project. So that was one of the points when the project started to become more about solidarity and how we reach each other across our differences than maybe about anything else. So I had to rely on my own friendships and my own relationships of trust to ask for those stories in the project, and they're in one of the light boxes. There was also solidarity called for in the archives for land rights and honouring Te Tiriti o Waitangi. And people talked a lot about caring about oppression that doesn't directly affect you. People saw homosexual law reform as a human rights issue that affected us all. And for me, that was really motivating to think about creative ways to bring us together. I heard this word mahi tohunga from Moana Jackson last week, the work to bring us together. I feel like that's really, really important. I wanted the project to be intergenerational, and that's one of the things that's happened through the archives. It's allowed me to put the voices of our ancestors into those light boxes, some of whom I know and some of whom I don't. And through that, I guess I've produced a new archive of our stories of embodied creative research and documentation. I just wanted to talk a little bit about Te Whanawhana. So everything in this project was invented. It was about listening and being guided, and the last stage was the dawn blessing, and the knowledge and wisdom of how to do that was brought by Te Whanawhana. Was powerful and generous and wise, and I will always be deeply grateful for that. I understand also that that was a real moment in our queer and taktapui history, and that's all been documented as well. So everything's been documented through photographs and audio and video, and as well as drawing and writing. The project was a range of experimental offers, and it was really revelatory for me about the ability of creative practice to hear, hold, reflect and record our stories, and to do that through workshops, through drawing people, through asking people for their stories, and for me as an artist, for that to be a service that I could offer to my community, to be a kind of skilled vessel for those stories. So that's my contribution to tonight. Ka kite.
Kia ora tatou. I'm Chappy Beasley, the National Coordinator of Inside Out. I just wanted to thank Elizabeth and Te Whanawhana for inviting us here to be part of this tonight. I think it's really... Yeah, it's a little bit intimidating speaking after these wonderful people have been collecting all this history, and I guess because we're an organisation that has only been around for 4 years and everything's new, and we're talking about social media. and we've done lots of work with people like Gareth, Te Whanawhana and Sian. And actually just this week we've been putting together a little pile to submit to Lagan, so it's really exciting. So I'm Tabby. I grew up in the UK, Suffolk, East Anglia. My family, my mum's side, comes from Inverness in Scotland, and moved to England. She doesn't know she doesn't know her dad, so that part of our family is a little gap for us. My dad's side of the family are mostly English, with also some Russian and Japanese connections, so we've little bits from here and there. And my family moved over to New Zealand in 2005. My parents split up and my mum decided to escape and go on holiday for 6 months. and she asked us where we wanted to go, and we were really into Lord of the Rings, so we said New Zealand. 9 days later, we flew here and never went back. I mean, I've now been 10 years later, I went back for my first time, and that was, yeah, so we were really lucky to come to Aotearoa and eventually get residency here, and just so grateful for that, yeah, that journey. And here I've lived in Tauranga, Blenheim, Nelson, now Wellington, Newtown, and really happy to be here.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Connor. I'm Takatapui, Rangitane or Kaituna, which is top of the South Island. I grew up in Fiji. I lived there for 8 years of my life, and then I shifted to Nelson. And I did lots of like activist-y kind of stuff there as a teenager. I've always been a very idealistic kind of person, very big dreamer, and so I went to school right after Tabby and led Nayland's Alliance of Queers and Straits after her, and I was on the board of Q Youth down there, and then Tabby invited me into to be a part of Inside Out when I shifted to Wellington a couple of years ago. So now I'm schools coordinator at Inside Out. I do I just network with schools and I guess a lot of our work can be found on social media, and Tabby and I are constantly like, what should we post on the Facebook or the Twitter or the Instagram? And I don't know, it feels weird having like an actual presentation about that, because it's just like I don't know.
It's like, how do we make this sound really intelligent?
So yeah, I'm really happy to be here, and I think a large part of what we do at Inside Out is we're a by youth for youth organisation, so it's pretty intimidating being surrounded a lot in our work by people a lot older and experienced than us, but we like to think that we have some kind of youthy perspectives.
Nice. Yeah, so Inside Out, so we're a national charity established 4 years ago. Kind of came out of my experience at high school, going to the first school probably in the whole Asia Pacific region to have a Queer Straight Alliance or Rainbow Diversity Group. When I was coming out, that was just incredible to have my school kind of affirming who I was, and to have a peer group to support me in that. But through that, I learned that a lot of other young people didn't have that same experience, and that, yeah, there's some really horrific bullying going on across the country in our schools, and that still is. So, yeah, I got involved just setting up a community group in Nelson called QS, which Connor and I were both part of, and then, once you finish school, there's not really much to do in Nelson, so it was kind of like, okay, need to get out of here. But also, there's this, I don't want to stop doing this work, it's so important, and through that work in QS, we got in touch with lots of other groups or schools would get in touch with us, kind of wanting to know how they could start up similar groups. So we just kind of really saw, when we're talking about gaps, we saw this gap for an organisation to really be doing work to support our schools, to support our young people in rainbow communities to be safe at school. So that's kind of where Inside Out started, and then it's just grown and grown. We've kind of expanded our vision to be a bit broader and think about all the ways that we can make young people feel safer in our communities. Schools are still our main focus, because we can't do everything, so we've got to start somewhere, but we'd like to look at different ways that we can do that.
So, can everybody read that? This is Inside Out. We are Kawato. We are, right here it says the concept of Kawato Inside Out is about aumahi, supporting people to be happy and accepting of themselves on the inside, and then continuing that support to see them be a positive influence in their communities, using their story to help others. So, I'm a really big, we're all really big supporters of telling our personal stories, and we do that all of our workshops and things like that. It really helps because most of our educators are usually queer, so they usually have lots of stories. And next slide.
Cool. So, as a youth organisation, social media is vital because that is how you reach a lot of young people. So that's our Facebook page promoting tonight's event. Hope to get some people along. Did anyone see it? I don't know. Here we go. one really cool thing about Facebook in terms of, again, looking at like where the gaps are, is that on Facebook you can, through a page, you can do this thing called Insights, and you can actually see who is interacting with your page, so you can see like what age groups, whereabouts in the country they are, gender, you can see how many people have interacted with each post that you do and stuff, so that's that can be really useful in terms of maybe figuring out who you're not reaching through this platform, or what things are working well to post. This is our Instagram. On the web, it looks different on your phone. One thing I love about Instagram is that you can, when you, yeah?
What's Instagram?
Instagram, okay. Great question. So it's Instagram is basically a mobile app where you share photos. I guess the Insta part is the idea that it's meant to be kind of instant, so you can show and people can see what you're doing in that moment. I can't say we're that good at doing it at the moment. I'm a latergram kind of person. And a lot of young people use Instagram, so, and it's really visual, so it's just the image. You can put a little caption, but it's mostly, about kind of the image and whatever that portrays. So for us, we mostly use it when we're at events, so we'll probably do one tonight, but hey, we're here doing this cool thing, and then anyone who likes our page can see what we've been doing, and I guess it's a way of sort of like a newsletter, but like a constant one in a way, because it's kind of people constantly knowing what you're what things you're involved in or supporting in the community, or so one thing I like is that on Instagram you can attach a location, so you can put where you are, and then people can search that location and see all the photos that were taken there. So for example, last week we had our National Day of Silence campaign, which is about breaking silence in schools about homophobia, biphobia and transphobia, and the silencing that lots of young people have to go through about their identities. So we went along to Wellington Girls College in this picture. They did an open mic to break the silence. We had a little chat. And then on Instagram, we were able to share that photo and put Wellington Girls College. So now whenever anyone, maybe past students or whoever, looks up Wellington Girls College on Instagram, they'll see this photo with the rainbow flag and the Day of Silence stuff. So it's kind of, it's also attaching history to like places in a way, which is, another way of, I guess, leaving that legacy. That's our Twitter page. Currently looking for board members, if anyone's interested. Tend to have a slightly older audience following us on Twitter, so it's interesting as well to see if you put things out on different the same things on different platforms, what responses you'll get or who will be engaged. Cool thing about Twitter is that you can retweet, so you can share what other people have posted. So like today we retweeted, or yesterday, Rainbow Youth up in Auckland, they were sharing a research study about people who are Asian and part of the Rainbow community. So we could just click a little button and that also goes out to all the people that follow us as well. YouTube, so less social media, because it's, I guess, that video and sharing stories, but it's another way that we like to put things out there, especially through some of our youth hui events that we've done, kind of capturing little experiences of that and putting it out to people. And I think, I'd like to think that in however many years' time people will be able to watch those and get a little glimpse of what we created in those environments. These are lots for our recent Day of Silence campaign, getting young people to share some of their personal stories. Kind of what it's like in 2016. We've got some from the year before as well. So maybe, what's it going to be like in 10 years' time when we, if we're capturing those stories about schools, what will it change? It's quite exciting. So I just wanted to talk about our Day of Silence campaign as one example of a way that we use social media. So that's... when I asked you to put your hands up, I'll just explain. So I'm going to explain the concept of a hashtag.
Take your time.
I'll try. I'm probably not the best person to do. Connor, can you help me here? How do you explain it?
It's your slide.
Okay. Very cool. Okay, so a hashtag. I'm not actually why it's a hashtag. Anyway. you can make a hashtag of anything, so we could make one for this event, we could put hashtag leaving a legacy or something. On lots of social media platforms, people will be able to search for that, and then all the posts that anyone has ever tagged with that will come up. So it's especially used on Instagram, Twitter and Tumblr, not so much on Facebook, a little bit.
It's like a library catalogue subject.
Yeah.
It's the wheel is constantly reinvented. Just when you're told it's totally out of date. suddenly create something which remarkably similar.
It was really useful for the Day of Silence because we'd be able to kind of track how the campaign's going across the country through that hashtag, so we'd search it up and then we'd be able to put that all on our website and stuff. Yeah, create.
And yeah, so I guess hashtags are often used by people who have similar interests, and they're often used for events for people to kind of collect things like this. So those are some of the things that got submitted for us that we put up on our Facebook. So Selfies for Silence, that's part of a campaign where people either themselves or their organisation says what they're doing to break the silence about homophobia, biphobia and transphobia. Yeah, which is cool. And this is just an example of some of the ones that we found by putting in the hashtag Day of Silence. We did that on Instagram. These are some of the pictures that came up from New Zealand, and these are, you can see, completely different people. We've never met some of those people. They're in different parts of the country who are joining our campaign, taking part in their schools or communities. And they can then search that and see who else is taking part. And I think, especially as a national organisation, I think social media is something that's so important for us as a way to for people to feel connected, and especially for young people in rainbow communities, in rural communities, as a way for them to feel like they're connected to something bigger and there are other people out there to support them. So, yeah, those are some of our Twitter.
So, yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about that connection because I think for a lot of young people, social media is this huge connection. So we have an annual hui at Tapu Tiranga Marae where we gather young people, old people, mostly young people from all over the country to come to Tapu Tiranga Marae and have about 3 nights, so like 4 days, of workshops and kōrero and food and just kind of all getting to know each other. And for a lot of people, it's kind of the first time they've been able to express their gender, their identity, their just who they are in an open and safe place. So we advertise that through social media. People find out about it through social media. And afterwards, all of the people that were at our hui go into like a Facebook group, and they all stay connected. So that's the group. And those are some of the comments that we get afterwards. People are still posting on from like even just a few days ago. So that top one says, I had a mean cry this morning because I realised I had so much support when I came out gender fluid. All I got to say is thank you everyone for showing me who I truly am. Much love. And the bottom one is quite, it's just those kind of comments came up a lot, and so it was also important for us to be able to see the value of our work and show kind of all of this connectivity with all these young people. And I think even though that might not be recorded, it is leaving a legacy through the connections formed and the friendships made. And it was like that for me in 2012 when I went to Hui Pitahi when I was a hui participant. And those groups aren't just limited to shift hui. They're like in so many different organisations throughout the country, right from Dunedin right up to Whangarei, all around basically. There are all these different groups, and I think it's just really important to acknowledge like those connections and how they are being charged through social media, and especially people in rural communities feeling more connected to a wider community. But I have some, as for the gaps, I had some questions so that I don't know the answer to. I'm not a social media expert. Who has access to social media technology and who doesn't? Does the consumability of social media limit its scope? By that I mean, social media is something that's very fast and often kind of superficial. It can be very raw, but it's something that's kind of, it's a popularity contest a lot. So the most popular stuff is generally the most consumed, and people want to put stuff on there that's popular, and I feel like that kind of limits sometimes what we can fit on social media. Are our online connections as real or as powerful? I don't really have an answer, but I feel like a lot of people would argue that they aren't, and a lot of people would argue that they are. As a collaborative field overridden in subjectivity, by that I mean social media is something that's created by everyone. It's like a hive mind, and everybody has their own agenda with social media. So when we've got like a hive mind full of agendas and subjectivities, like, can we really find like a truthful narrative in that? Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. I was just really struck by what you said just then about the most popular stories being the ones that get retold, and that totally fits in with what was said earlier about even within the archive, the stuff that's most readily available and most popular gets told over and over. So it's something just to bear in mind, that even if we've collected the information, there's still particular narratives that get recycled and reinforced because of its ease of access or its perceived popularity. So kia ora, we're going to take a break on this section, have a stretch, come outside, have a drink, and we're going to start the next section of tonight. Alrighty. So, this is a practical... the last part of this section. And just so people are aware, part of this coming to this workshop came out of two places. One of them was Leggins talking about strategic planning, some of the things that we need to take leadership for and responsibility for or support within our different communities. And the other part of it is the project Te Whana Whana is leading with the National Rainbow Strategy. And that is about wanting to coordinate our efforts across the country and across our diverse communities. And so, of course, keeping our stories, making sure they're told and recorded and preserved is a key part of that. So just to flag, I will not be writing these out and sending them to people. It's not going to happen. This is the process. It's us talking, it's us thinking, and then this gets fed into the groups that will do some of this work. And so that's why... splitting up the issues is so important, because some of it, it's going to be really obvious. Key organisations will take on those roles, but others, it's as communities and as groups and people who work together, how do we collectively work on some of those things? So we're going to take people who feel an affinity to a particular section. I want you to grab off that section off the wall and find you a space. We can go back and grab your chairs to come out here, sit around the tables, or just talk amongst yourself and just think, what are some of the key priorities that need to happen in that area, and who should do it? Because dealing with homelessness and invisibility of LGBTIQ young people who are homeless, who's responsible for that? We don't have a specific group that does that. So therefore, does it mean we need a new group, or are there particular groups who are on the edge of that that could work together to progress that as an issue, if we think that's a particular priority? And I would just like to say how pleased I am that even though this is a particular focus for this evening, how broad everybody has been in their thinking. And again, that says to me how connected are the people in this room and how connected our community is, that we're thinking way, way past our little parts of what we do and how we think. So I'm guessing the practical things, people who work in archives, libraries and recording specifically might like to take this away. We don't have a lot of paper, so write small. And as many post-its as you like to write a novel. It could be like a whole multicoloured chart. Because Elizabeth forgot the whiteboard markers. Yes, so I'd like to suggest you grab those ones. People who are particularly interested in around identity and visibility and voices is probably another natural grouping.
These ones around representation and how communities can work. And then over here, yeah, overlooking voices, how do we actually get to increase the numbers of voices? So these are clearly overlapping as well, and that's fine.
I've got a question.
Yes.
If we're thinking about areas or organisations beyond just the LGBTI organisations, can we point them out?
Absolutely.
If we think that, that it's essential either government or...
Absolutely.
Or, you know, United Nations should get onto this, if we think that that's a... a route that should be explored as well?
Definitely. Like other groups who are not in the room and other organisations and agencies, because then that sends a signal about who we need to partner with, who we need to put pressure on.
Is that part of advocacy?
Yes.
Advocacy, who else could do this?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Get here and go to the council or go to the...
Part of the solution.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Definitely. So just, I would like people to come over and even grab some things off here, form a little group, and it could be completely random, that's all good, and just have a think about what are some of the great creative ways that we can start addressing. Given what we already do so well in our community, how do we use the systems we've all got set up, the frameworks we have, how do we, start sorting this out.
Okay, so well, this group of archivists and librarians took those kind of issues, not solely. There's sort of more policy and inclusiveness things, but we sort of grouped them into the need for preservation of digital records of the communities and of individuals. So long-term preservation and how we work that out. And then archiving of social media, which is an ongoing headache for many communities all over the world. But so that's something that's being worked on, and we want to keep in touch with the work that other groups are doing. different sorts of access to LGBTIQ+, etc., including online access. So that was all the different ways of making material that's in our archives in some way or being contributed accessible to different communities, which may be physically or it may be online. And one thing about the one sort of subgroup, I guess, was that it's important, for example, especially relating to social media, is to keep records of passwords and so on, which is like we were comparing it to, you know, PO box keys and bank account signatories and all those sort of things that groups have to keep a track of. Having really good documentation of all of these processes. And there was a specific proposal for a queer digital working group to start meeting regularly, which has been discussed before, so hopefully we can make it happen. And then there were more policy things about making LAGANs in particular more responsive to connecting with younger generations and the perception of LAGANs as only for lesbians and gays. So those are issues to be dealt with. And then there was other kind of ethical issues that were mentioned, and maintaining the continuity of collecting. So it was this was all about practicalities and policies of archiving and preserving the material that records our existence now and contributes to all the legacies we want to leave.
Awesome, thank you. That's great.
Can I just add to that too?
Yeah.
Which is about connecting up the dots beyond our known world of collectors and archivists through to the other museums and other institutions, places, universities and stuff like that
yeah.
that have things.
Yeah, that's right, making those known. Yeah. Well, and sometimes in supporting them to interpret them too.
Yeah.
Mm.
Te Papa.
Te Papa, yeah. Mm. Places.
Well, Te Papa does make an effort to interpret, whereas some places don't even start. To identify things as of interest to researchers into same-sex relationships or whatever, however we want to express it.
Human.
So these homelessness and disability were areas that were looked at, and I guess these are wider society issues as well as LGBTI issues, and the and really it was just a concern about keeping the profile, raising the profile of those things, improving the services, particularly for people with disabilities. But the other thing was actually raising the quality of our life expectations in terms of, you know, the life beyond being hopeless, maybe in down and out if they're homeless or stuff like that. Or they're in that situation because financially, economically, the world's against them, that type of thing. So it's raising society's expectations of what we should expect.
And I think it's probably us supporting our gay, lesbian, Kakapoe welfare groups, which exist in the community, and Andrew mentioned tonight that, you know, they are there, and encouraging them, supporting them, working for them, all getting involved.
Yeah, working with them. And the other issue was burnout, which sort of changed around a little bit. But this was recognising people who work really hard in the community for the work that they give, and I guess the priorities were ensuring that we all take care of each other, each other's health, rest, sharing the load, have fun, I guess, might actually be quite good. But also having clear visions and values around the work that you're doing so that it has real meaning and you know what you're focusing on. Mm. Kia ora.
Thank you.
Can I add one thing to the, not so much the burnout, but the one before, which is services and that for old people?
Yep.
I don't think that that's something that's really had much work done on it yet.
Yep.
And it's another sort of end of the sort of isolation, can be isolated.
And it's an area where it's very difficult to get even older people interested. They seem to want to shut their... We tried in Rainbow Wellington. There was a member of the board who really tried to get an elderly gay project up. He said whenever he spoke to people, they just did not want to know. And it wasn't just the young ones that said that. So that's often part of the whole battle. People want to close their eyes and shut their ears to the problem until it probably hits them.
No, thank you. Can I just admin-wise, if someone's made a suggestion to add something, could you please, whoever had that sheet, physically add that so we don't lose any of that kia ora?
Kia ora, I'm Adrian. And our group talked mostly about infighting within our community. And I think this actually relates a bit to the burnout one that just came up. But just that... particularly for those of us who are working in organizations, working in groups, working to create events, that's the place that I'm speaking from. There's just, maybe I'll just tell my personal story, but and I'll throw Karen in it too. So Karen and I are part of an organizing team running Wellington Pride and Down in the Park. And so a lot of what we do in particular is trying to put on events every year to represent the entire spectrum of the community, that everyone in the community is there, LGBTQIA, and, you know, every letter possible, the new emerging ones that are coming all the time. And we're trying really hard to represent all of the diversity, cultural, age, you know, so many different things. And in that space, it's really difficult because a lot of groups come together and are fighting each other. There's a lot of fighting that goes on, and not just disagreements, but really kind of attacking each other. And there's a lot of emotional stuff happening. And so we just talked a lot about that in our group. So what are some of the solutions or suggestions for dealing with that? And We talked a lot about what we could learn from the past, and this isn't a new issue that we have factions or different, you know, divisions in our community, but at various points in time, we've come together, we've crossed those divisions and come together to fight against a common cause, say for homosexual law reform or different things like marriage equality, where we have these big issues. So it's kind of like a unifying issue, and we were just talking about what maybe we need something like that now, and what is that one unifying issue that, or maybe multiple, but what are those unifying issues for our entire community? So we didn't have an answer to that, but I'm just putting that out to the room. And maybe that would help us try to start working together a bit more. But we also talked about maybe having regular conferences, actually calling out the fact that there is a lot of this fighting going on, and maybe we need to find different ways to listen to each other better and have safer spaces, and so have a space specifically for that on a regular basis, maybe, or once a year, or whoever.
That redirects the energy. Yeah. So actually, maybe it's okay that there's, well, obviously it's okay that there's different views, but how do we have a safe space for that to happen and learn about each other as the community evolves over time and changes?
Mm. Yeah, because, I mean, we're talking here about all the different issues. We just happen to get this one. But all the other issues, we want people to be able to come together and work together. And so that's not happening that well, you know, often. So what are some of the solutions to that? Yeah, and then this contributes to burnout. All of this stuff contributes to burnout, and taking care of each other, I think, is a really good thing, but often we're not taking care of each other, so how do we address that? Again, that's a question for the room. Mm. Oh, and there was some stuff around visibility and just, you know, when we're making really difficult decisions. For instance, another personal example, or from the work that we do around canceling movie fundraisers, for instance. You know, this is something that we often talk about. We'll have a fundraiser with a movie, and then you have people who say, oh, we don't like the way that our group is being represented in that film, for instance. And then we, as a committee, sit around and debate it for hours. We don't just make that decision lightly. We sit around and we go, okay, which way do we go with this decision? And often it's disagreements, dissenting views. Some people will be unhappy if you cancel, and some people will be unhappy if you show it. So who do you go with in that case? And so we often end up going, well, actually, it's the people who have less power, who have are more vulnerable and have less visibility in our community, who we end up siding with often. Not siding with, but we go with, you know, that decision goes that way. But that's just in our committee, but, you know. So there's just a lot. I think those discussions need to happen at a wider level rather than just in our little, you know, small committee. But maybe we should all be having those discussions as a community. So,
and naming it. So it's okay that we've got these different opinions and experiences. Let's name it and then do something more positive with that.
Mm. Awesome. Thank you. Yep. Can I get you there to add just right naming it? Yeah. And can I also add restorative practice?
Yes.
and our last group.
There's your new speakers, if you'd like to introduce yourself as well, just a name.
Kia ora, ko Mahara Davis toku ingoa.
And Shirley Cameron, ko Shirley toku ingoa. So really, we're almost not quite a group. We lost some people along the way. But anyway, this was really my interest. There was sort of some very diverse things that I've pulled into here. And so we're really talking about, because some of them were about really what we don't know about the community. So it's about doing the research. So it's the research that you're going to see, you know, all the things that you're going to record. And so yeah, there's the oral histories of different groups, but there's also other social research. And, you know, so there's a lot of anecdotal evidence, you know, and comments that people make about the community, but that has not been researched properly in many areas. I'm sure you're aware, you know, just looking at something that I saw, was reading about the other day, that how little research had been done on suicide for young or all gay people, and even though it's anecdotally known that there's a lot, it's very, very hard to find that out because it's not recorded at the time. Mm-hmm. And there's all those kinds of, you know, So the research wouldn't just be purely research. It would be, it would have practical outcomes for gay people. And it's who's doing the research. I mean, it's not really done through organisations. We're doing it as individuals, or, you know, through university, whatever. And I don't know if I just put a big question mark about groups being involved in research. A couple of owners are, you know, not sure about the funding either, you know, as to where that could come. But I mean, it's the basis of building up a big picture, really. A full picture of the gay community.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, thank you everybody for your contributions, and we believe that a lot of what we've captured in the stickers and on the papers is a type of a guide to where we're going to keep moving, but also the conversations that you're having in the room, we believe will be part of what happens after this and how things develop in the future. So a final thank you, and we hope you had fun this evening, or at least be sure that you actually did some work and it was really valuable. As I say, we're not necessarily going to write back and report directly that this is an informal group of people who happen to be able to come tonight and were interested, that there are many other people are going to feed in to different parts of the strategy. But for sure, Legends is going to be continuing to work on this work. Te Whanawhana, for sure, will be continuing to work on this. And through that, working with all the organisations. Because I just want to do a quick recap of actually the organisations that are represented. And not necessarily that you're here with your hat on to speak on their behalf, but just who's in the room. So I would just like to do a final work round to finish off. So, you know, Te Whanawhana and Legends. And Arataiohi, so I'm on the peak body for youth development. So I'd like to just do a quick whip round of organisations.
Pride NZ.
Cool.
Lesbian and Gay Archives.
Violet from Wellington Lesbian Website.
Lesbian and Gay Archives.
Te Whanawhana.
Really, the my radio program, Kappa Te Gay, which I do on Coast Texas Radio.
Wellington Pride and Out in the Park.
Te Whanawhana, Legends.
Wellington Pride and Lesbian Radio Show.
The Gay Fathers Group and myself personally.
Volunteer for Legends.
I'm just an individual, but I've become a recent Legends volunteer.
Thank you so much, and that's us. I just wonder if we could do a quick karakia to finish things off, and that's our night.
Amen.